everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Comic Source. This is your host, Jace. This is a comic book content creator conversation. I'm really excited about today's guest. He gets to talk to all the big names. He's done incredible things like the Todd McFarlane documentary that was released earlier this year. Hope you've had a chance to check it out. I've been lucky enough to know him for a few years now, covering conventions and such. So my pleasure to welcome to the show, Mike Avila. Mike, thanks for joining me.
Hey, good to be here, man.
Yeah, it's so great to finally have you on the show. I love talking, giving the listeners a little peek behind the scenes about why we do what we do. And it's a little different for you because this is your career. So, I'm really interested to pick your brain, and we'll kind of, you can take us along on this journey, how you ended up here. But we always like to ask people when they come on for the first time, sort of about their secret origin, how they came to be interested in comics. So, I know this, maybe some of them don't, but did you read comics as a kid? Were they a big part of your childhood? Take us on that journey.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Comics were a huge part of my childhood. I was reading comics, I think, since about 1977. I'd probably seen one or two of them at 7-Eleven or something, but I clearly remember reading them by 77, because I was reading Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, and The Avengers. Those are probably the first two series that I was reading on a regular basis. And back then it was tougher to be a regular reader because you had to go hunt them down at convenience stores. And I mean, I don't think I went into my first comic book store until I was like 3 years later. So it was a challenge. But yeah, for me, I always tell people this, comics kind of helped me learn how to read. I was already reading by then, obviously, but they helped grow my vocabulary, and it helped spark an interest in English for me, because I'd read things like The Avengers and there'd be words that, you know, guys like Jim Shooter and David Michelinie would write in there. And I could still follow the story, but then there'd be a couple of words where I was like, wait, what is that? So then I would ask my mom, she goes, well, get a dictionary and look it up. And so I started doing that back then, you know, in the Stone Ages, we all had dictionaries at the house. and I would look them up, and that's how I would learn it. And I really think comics gave me a leg up on expanding my vocabulary at a very early age. I don't think it's any coincidence that my best subject in school was always English. And, you know, in elementary school, reading, because I was genuinely interested in it, because I was reading in my spare time as a hobby.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's true. I mean, it's very similar to me. I remember riding my bike, trying to go and make sure you didn't miss an issue because this convenience store didn't get it. Maybe check the 7-Eleven across town. Yeah. And I agree with you. My love of comics from an early age of kindergarten sparked my love of reading my whole life. And that's, you know, I think it really is a gateway. And I think it's kind of, and I know there's a lot of complex parts of this. It's not a simple answer, but I think it's to the detriment of the industry that they're not available kind of widespread like they were when I was a kid. You kind of feel the same way?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I've talked about this with a lot of folks, and there really isn't, you know, and I get the frustration of people, and, you know, they say the comics are too expensive and they're priced out of the range of kids. I get all that. The problem is, the comics are more expensive now, a variety of reasons, right? There's inflation, there's the cost of paper that has always gone up. But mainly the reason comics cost more is because talent is getting paid more. I have a hard time getting upset about that, because now comic creators are able to make a living wage and you know, live well.
Right.
The comics that you and I were reading when we were kids were made by guys who were barely making ends meet, I'm sure. Right. There were a few exceptions even back then, you know, the John Burns and George Perez's of the world. But for the most part, if you were a comic book artist or writer back then, you weren't rich. So there's a, I don't know what the answer is there. I mean, things cost more now. We're never going to see 40-cent comics ever again. And we probably shouldn't, because that means that comic creators are making no money. But I think getting books to be easily accessible for young fans is in the industry's best interest, and they still haven't figured out a way to do that. DC's tried, in particular, DC's tried with their YA books that they're doing now, which are really good, and introducing their characters through different means. Random House is doing some great kid graphic novels. My youngest daughter and I have just been plowing through Judd Winnick's Hilo series, which are amazing. They're great books. Are they comic books like you and I view comic books, you know, like this? Not really. But they're graphic novels, they're graphic arts, and that's good enough for me. I don't know the answer to getting regular floppy single issues in the hands of kids. That's just not how how this generation or the last generation has been brought up to read those. So I think the industry has to accept that and move past it and figure out a different way to reach that audience. And I think the graphic novel route is the way to go because it's more bang for your buck. You know, $7-$8 gets you a really well-told, well-drawn story. And I think that's much better than expecting them to go and be hooked on $4, or are they $4.99 now? I can't even tell anymore.
Yeah.
$3.99 or $4.99 X-Men and Spider-Man comics. I don't think that's a feasible option.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, DC, they also tried the Walmart stuff. And again, I just don't think it hit.
That was a great move by them.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was great to get the visibility out. I don't know that it did as well as they'd hoped, but I'm also of the opinion that kind of the spinner racks that we used to see today, that kind of thing and getting something on a cheaper price point, maybe 99 cents. That's sort of what the digital marketplace is trying to hit. That's kind of the spinner rack where you can go and browse things on Comixology or what have you. But it hasn't caught on for everybody yet. Have you heard anything or you have an opinion about kind of the digital going digital?
I like digital. As a matter of fact, you know, I live in an apartment now. And the last thing I want is a stack of, you know, single issues all over the place.
Right.
I tell all the reps from companies who send me, you know, review material, send me PDFs. I'm happy to have that. If there's a really nice hardcover, you want to send it to me because that's part of the release, you know, seeing the presentation, great. Happy to get those. I buy very few single issues. Now, mainly for the few comics that I'm reading monthly now, mm-hmm. for a lot of reasons. But I love digital comics. I think it's a great way to do it. I think we need to realize that little kids in particular look at things differently than we do. They do the vertical scroll a lot.
Right.
My kids, they're on TikTok. Everything is vertical. I think that's the way to reach them with digital comics. I'm not sure the killer app has been made there. I mean, for me and you, Comixology works fine. Reading comics at DC Universe, just fine. I don't use the Marvel app, but I'm assuming it's the same style. I mean, that's fine. I think for younger kids, I think we need to adapt the comic books to the platform that they're used to seeing. And at least judging from my kids and their friends, it's all vertical,
yeah,
not horizontal.
Yeah, and that's a good point. That's how Webtoon does it, but that platform, right. I never recommend for kids. All their stuff is pretty mature. So yeah, I think actually there may be.
And that's an insanely popular app.
Yeah,
like, around Webtoon the world, is incredibly popular.
Yeah, around the world, millions and millions of users. Yeah, so
because that's how they're used to it. Because especially in Asia, that's how they're used to reading digital comics and digital content in general.
So anybody out there who's looking to make a quick buck, there you go. You got $1 million. And Mike and I would be happy to take a consulting fee on that. So,
yes, I would. Yes, I would.
Well, Mike, let's talk a little bit about your involvement with Sci-Fi Wire and Behind the Panel. Kind of let everybody know what you do now and a little background of you know how you got there.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I've been working on and off with sci-fi in some capacity for about 10 years. When I went full-time freelance after leaving a job that at NBC where I was doing a movie show. And I was proud to say I was probably the first producer to create original digital video programming for sci-fi. And over the years, it expanded. I mean, we did a six-episode companion series to their old show, Hollywood Treasure, which was fun, where I got to go and find these collectors who have all these amazing movie and television artifacts. I did a new show called Blaster TV with Battlestar Galactica star Nikki Klein, who's also been in the news for other things the past couple of years. That's a conversation for another for another interview. And then the last like three, four years, I've been doing a lot of comic book centric work for them. Behind the Panel kind of just evolved from a lot of the interviews that I was doing at conventions for them. With different comic book writers and artists and other people in the business. I enjoy talking to the folks in the business. I think the business of comics and the process of making comics is as fascinating as the comics themselves. So I've always been fascinated by that. Just like I've always been interested in the process of making movies just as much as the movies. So I kind of approached it as I wanted to kind of give people behind the scenes look at the lives of the people that make the comics that, that we read. And thankfully people enjoyed it. Seemed to be good viewership for it. And I think we did 120 plus different interviews over the last couple of years, including some really great ones. I mean, we did a few long form pieces, including that five-part Image Comics documentary piece, So Much Damage. That was a lot of fun because we were really able to do what a lot of people hadn't done, which is kind of tell the entire story of Image Comics up until that point, which was 2017, the 25th anniversary, and kind of put it all together in one spot, talking to all the original creators and founders of the company. So that was a lot of fun. Pretty much after that, it was really easy for me to get comic people to talk to me. Because, you know, when you have McFarlane and Larson and Lee and Liefeld and Silvestri talking to you, then pretty much everyone else will say, oh, wait, well, you know, I'll talk to that guy. Plus, all those guys, through various connections, know, like, everybody in the business. Yep. So it was really easy. Like, I remember I talked to Jim Valentino, and it goes back to, like, making sure that you kind of have a good rep, I guess, in the industry, because I was able to get Valentino to talk to me for that series because Colleen Doran had enjoyed some interviews I'd done with her for Sci-Fi. And so when I emailed Valentino blindly, he actually responded to me and he goes, sure, I'll do it. I've heard good things about you. And I was like, oh, really? From who? From my buddy Colleen. And she's not a big fan of doing interviews. So he goes, she enjoyed it. You know, I'll be happy to do it. So I was like, great. And so that kind of worked in my favor. The same way I got John Byrne to talk with me. Walt Simonson had done an interview with me. Walt and John are really good friends, and Walt put in a good word. And so John said, sure. Did an email interview with me for his Star Trek book that he was doing at IDW. And then he enjoyed that. And then from there, we started doing some on-camera stuff.
Yeah, it's so interesting because just like me, you know so many of these people. You know, on a personal level, you've met them face-to-face at conventions. And so much of comics, and I know you know this working with sci-fi, kind of there's that part of fandom that can be kind of toxic, right? They sort of obsess about things and they take ownership of it. And then if a creator wants to do something different, they face that backlash. And you got to remember, listeners, that these creators, they're just people too, you know? So they're not looking to come on a show and be attacked or, you know, whatever. They want to know that you're, you know, kind of looking out for them too. And I'm not saying you let them off the hook if they've, you know, done something or you throw them all softball questions. But you got to find that balance, right, Mike?
It's just, I mean, look, I've been around and, you know, working in TV news kind of helped prepare me for this. And for a long time, I was a producer helping people prepare for interviews, especially with a lot of interviews with celebrities. And that's a different tactic than if you're doing a news interview with some lawyer representing some scumbag criminal in a notorious case. There's a certain finesse you need to have. I mean, look, if you're on 60 Minutes, you can approach it guns blazing and they're going to talk with you because you're 60 Minutes and you got a great, huge platform. If you don't have those things going for you, then you can either take two approaches. You can take the sycophant approach, which you're not going to ask any sort of challenging or negative question. Hey, whatever, it's fine. That works for some people and what they're after, that's great. For me, I'm not out to hammer anybody or nail somebody to the wall, but there are some questions I have for certain creators that may not be their most favorite question. Yeah. And so then my trick is, okay, I'm going to ask this question. It may or may not go down well, but I should ask it in a nice way.
Right.
There's no reason to be rude about it. I remember going back to John Byrne. One of the things, I think it was the second interview I did with him when I was invited to his studio, which is like amazing. And like the greatest thing ever was to spend the day at John Byrne's studio. My God, it was unbelievable. And so I had a million questions to ask. And funny side note, I woke up in my hotel in the state where he lives. Some people know where he lives. I'll keep it private just so people don't go digging up where he lives. Welcome to the hotel. I've written out all my notes on all my cards. I had 7 or 8 note cards full of all these questions because John said, you'll stay as long as I feel like talking. Then right. You can leave with a smile on his face. And I left the notes in the hotel room. And I realized that when we pulled up to his house, and I was like, great. You know, the producer that was with me, John Irwin, was like, oh, do you need to go back to get him? And I said, it's good. I've got all these questions in my head.
Yeah.
Pretty much I just took everything from here and I just wrote them down. Right. Just because it's John Byrne and I know his career pretty well. But there was a couple of questions that I wanted to ask him about his reputation. I mean, it's no secret. John's got a rep, earned or not, for being a prickly sword and somebody who does not suffer fools lightly and who says what's on his mind. I mean, it is what it is. And I asked him. And I remember I thought about how I wanted to ask him because I go, look, I'm in this guy's house. And he invited me to go talk with him. And I told him, I go, I want to ask you about a million different things. And he didn't put any restrictions or anything. But I go, I'm not going to be, you know, for lack of a better word, a dick about it. So I asked him, I go, okay, you know about your reputation. And, you know, some people think that you've said some things, some rude things. And I asked him, I go, anything you said that you'd, I think I asked him, I go, anything that you said that you'd like to take back? He didn't even hesitate. He goes, nope, not really. And he was like, I think his answer was, over the years, I've come to realize there are just a lot of people that are dumber than me and say dumb things, and I'm just not going to lose any sleep over it. And I was like, okay. We talked back and forth about it, and that was it. He's an incredibly honest and to-the-point person. So, you know, he's also at that rarefied point that he's a legend in his field, and he's 7 years old, and that's that magic age where you can say what, you know, you kind of want to say what you want to say, yeah. And that's it. And that's how it is. But the point is, meandering to it, but basically ask those questions. Just, there's a way to ask tough questions without being rude about it.
Right.
I've asked creators about stories that didn't work out. I think it was Dan Slott in an interview I did with him where I talked to him about, you know, what changes, what regrets maybe you had from your Spider-Man run? You were on it for 10 years. There's no chance you don't have any regrets or things you do over again. And he talked a little bit about that. And it was fine. I mean, I think if you approach it the right way, most comic creators in particular in this industry, they're going to answer honestly and truthfully about things. I mean, G. Willow Wilson, in an interview we did at the start of the pandemic, we talked a little bit about Wonder Woman, and she was like apologetic about the run. He goes, I never really thought I had a good grasp of the character, she said. And it was like, I didn't get that view. I enjoyed her run quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And she was quite adamant about the fact that she felt that she kind of dropped the ball on that. And it was interesting to hear her being honest about that. Look, it's a grind. Comics are a grind. It's a deadline-driven business, and it's a pressure-filled business. And you got to try to follow up when you're doing books like Wonder Woman. You got to follow in the heat, you know, the paths carved by legends, right? Think of all the great people that have worked on Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
And no matter how great of a writer or artist you are, sometimes you may not think your work stands up to the past. And it's just interesting. I don't know. To me, I enjoy the back and forth conversation because these are questions that I'd like to just ask them even back when I was a fan.
Right.
Now I'm lucky enough to have a platform where I get to do it on camera for other people to watch. And I hope that people get some sense of that. And it's not just the typical, so tell me about the book and the idea and what was the inspiration behind it. I mean, who cares about that? Like, I try not to do those kind of interviews just because, one, other people can do it better than me. And to dissect, what were you trying to do between panel one and number two? That's not really my thing.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. And there's any number of interviews they've already done answering those questions, and you can go and see those. And you can always tell too, when they're giving you one of those answers they've given a thousand times, they're just reciting it, you know? So I like to steer away from it. It reminds me, you talking about John Byrne, when I talked to Tom King, and again, it goes back to having a good reputation and being respectful. Because we know that his Heroes in Crisis wasn't really well received. And I know that's a sensitive subject for him, but I also know him. He knows my rep, and he, you know, when I talked to him over Christmas, I asked him about it. And yeah, like you said, I got an honest answer, a good answer that I hadn't heard him say anywhere else. So everything Mike's saying, listeners, is really true. Having that reputation, being respectful, being knowledgeable, knowing your stuff, it's invaluable, right, Mike?
Yeah, it absolutely is. One, I love Tom King, one of the great guys in the biz, and I love talking with him because his fandom oozes from him in the interviews. Yeah. And if you hit the right notes and you do your research about the books to bring up and the runs to ask him about, you're going to get some great stuff, because over the years I've talked with him about, I mean, anything Kirby related is going to get you gold from him.
Yeah.
So it's great. But he's also going to answer honestly. And, you know, we've talked in the past about how his Batman run was received. You know, not everyone loved it. I did, but a lot of people didn't, mm-hmm. especially coming after, you know, a run that was, I don't know anybody who didn't like the Snyder Capullo run. That's that rare run that pretty much everyone was just the greatest, you know? But I love Tom's run, and I know a lot of other people did, but I also know some people who didn't. And if you're on the internet at all, you'd see it. And I think it helps to have a little bit of time too. I think Tom is much more capable of answering honestly about things maybe he'd do differently with Heroes in Crisis after the, you know, after letting him marinate for a while. And
see, right. Yeah.
Kind of hard to come in hot with that question. You know, an issue number six just drops. So what do you think you dropped the ball on with this series? Yeah. I mean, you know, timing matters, I think, when you're talking to folks, and that goes for filmmakers and whatnot. Cause I've talked to filmmakers and actors about projects that didn't work a year or two down the road. And I've gotten some great responses from them, some honest responses. It's in the rearview mirror. At that point, it becomes part of the resume. It falls into that job part of life, right?
Right.
Where you can look back and say, yeah, that movie didn't work. Filmmakers are really honest about that stuff. If you give them a little bit of space between asking, like I said, don't ask them on opening night. Hey, so what would you change right now if you could go back into the editor room tonight? Yeah. I mean, you got to pick the right moment to ask that. And I think in particular with comics, we have the advantage that there's lead time. By the time we're talking about the series, they had written that story months ago. But if it's an ongoing, remember, they still have other issues coming up. So I don't know. It's tricky and it's a balancing act. Comics is a very tough industry to do really solid journalism in, because you're beholden in a lot of ways to the gatekeepers. Unless you focus exclusively on creator-owned books, you're beholden to the DCs and the Marvels of the world.
Right.
Not so much Image, but you know, DC and Marvel in particular, you're beholden to them to give you the access to their talent, because you know more and more they have exclusive talent. And even if they're not exclusive, a Brian Bendis isn't going to go and trash his own book. Because, you know, he wants people to buy the book. So I get that. You remember, comic book guys are their own salespeople and their own sales and marketing team, which is something that no other entertainment industry has. I mean, TV, maybe, but not as directly as comic books.
Right.
You know, writers and artists, they got to go out there and plug their stuff and chill it. So they're in a really weird spot. So it's really a balancing act. And I've told this to people who've reached out to me and asked about getting into, you know, comics and covering comics. And I go, one, there's almost no money. If you're lucky, you find a way to make some money. So if you want to make money in it, good luck. Obviously you want to know your stuff, but you also have to understand, you have to really toe the line between what journalism is and what marketing is, because in a lot of ways, comics journalism is a co-branded marketing, because we all want the industry to succeed. So unless you want to take the approach of being the, you know, that site that wants you to find out all the gossip in the offices and all the negative stuff and make your money that way, good luck getting all the contacts to give you all that stuff. Then you have to figure out a way to work within the system. And if you earn a good enough rep that people trust you to talk with them, and you find a nice way, and a respectable way to talk about books that maybe you didn't love, and you do it in a way that the creators respect your honesty and the publicists respect your tact, because those are two different things, then you can go somewhere and you can do it. It's tricky though. It's really tricky.
Yeah, it is. You gotta, you know, you get that access. you can't be trashing books like Mike says, but you also got to be honest because you got to keep your integrity for the people that are, you know, consuming the content that you're creating. So yeah, it's a balancing act. We talk about it all the time. And I find that over the years, as comics have become kind of the center of pop culture, these billion-dollar movies, and they've become more corporatized, that's when the gatekeeping really started being a thing. You know, if we were doing this back in the 70s, it would be just like, you know, the Wild West, whatever, talk to anybody.
Totally.
It's a different.
Even the 90s.
Yeah. Just a different world now. Well, let's shift gears here, Mike. Let's talk a little bit about the worth of comic. Like why do you feel that it's worth it to talk to these creators, to give the human side of behind the scenes about not just them as people, but also the stories and that they're creating. Where's the value in comics as a medium for you?
I mean, these are where we're getting our modern myths, right? Like, I mean, you see it on television. Look at WandaVision dominating the conversation right now. The MCU, the DC universe, the DC animated films, the games. I mean, I know tons of people who know about the DC characters from the video games more than anything else, which is mind-boggling to me, but that's a huge market out there. The comics are where we're getting all of the present-day mythology that surrounds us and that fascinates us. So why wouldn't we want to learn about the guys who create these stories and learn where they came from and what inspired them? Because by doing that, then you tie it into the books that came before them that guys like Tom King were reading at the same time I was, even though Tom's a few years younger than me. And you tie it in, and then you get to let people know about the people that were working in comics in the Bronze Age, the Burns, the Perez's, the Ross Andrews, Ron Wilson, all these guys who, you know, some have been forgotten, some have not, right? You know, the Jerry Conways and Roy Thomases of the world who are writing an ungodly amount of stories every month that are still reprinted to this day. And they were cranking it out like if it was a factory job, yeah. But they somehow found a way to create new characters. Like, I'm always fascinated by the Bronze Age, and I always try to inform people about it because they go, you know what people were doing in the 1970s in comics, man? They were grinding away, making no money at Marvel or DC, and they were creating new characters every single month just because they had 22 pages to fill out. And those characters are still lasting. Look at characters like Blade and the Night Nurse. I'm just, you know, random ones that are coming to my brain. Werewolf by Night. All these just, oh, from one month to the next. They didn't spend 6 months at a retreat, you know, with DC editors coming up with those. That was, you know, that was these guys just coming up with them, you know, from January to February or February to March. It's like insane. Look at the X-Men. Look what Chris Claremont and Dave Cockrum and John Byrne were doing on that book. The things that they were creating. I mean, you know, Phoenix, Dark Phoenix, you know, taking them to the Savage Land. I mean, even like one, you know, two issue stories like the Proletariat, twofer with Colossus, like crazy stuff. Dazzler shoehorned in there because of a Jim Shooter directive. Yeah. Like the sheer insane, irrational creativity that was involved in comics in the 70s and even into the 80s before creator-owned really exploded is mind-boggling to me, because look at all the characters that have been co-opted and multi-purposed from that era. To TV, to movies, and things like that. It's crazy if you think about it. I mean, the Marvel Netflix show used a bunch of them. All those shows used a ton of those characters. I mean, the Punisher was, was a supporting character in Amazing Spider-Man who would show up every year and a half or so, and it was a big event when he would show up in Spider-Man back then. And, you know, for a time, he was like the biggest thing going at Marvel, and he's still a big deal, although problematic. As some of my followers have realized from my story. But like, that's a fascinating thing for me. And then you go back to the Silver Age, right? And then you have the Kirbys, the Ditkos, the Hex of the world. All these folks, you know, Don Heck, supremely underrated Marvel Silver Age artist, right? You have all these guys that a lot of newer fans may be able to name drop, but how well do they know the work, and how well do they know the stories of how their creativity was done under the constant churn of the deadline clock, trying to just, you know, keep the lights on at their house. I mean, the amount of work that Kirby himself did was staggering.
Yeah.
Just staggering. And it was a different time. And I think for me, if you ever want to know how something works now, you need to go back a ways to figure out how it worked then and see how it went from then to now. And I've always looked at my interviews and things like, and the things that I do, whether for Sci-Fi or IGN or whoever, to be focused on that, giving people a sense of how the sausage is made and how different the recipe is today, you know, than the 70s or 60s recipe. Because I think it's important to know that with an industry like comics, which depends so much on its past, everything that comics does is built upon the past. Whether it's DC's never-ending quest to fix their continuity, or Marvel's you know push to reinvent their heroes and villains in different ways for the modern day, right? All of that depends on their history. So you got to learn the history.
Yeah, and so many, and I find this to be true. So many of the creators that are working now, you see the fingerprints of the things they read when they were comic fans, because so many of them, you know, grew up reading, like Matthew Rosenberg's run on Uncanny X-Men. You see the fingerprints of the Claremont and the Byrne stuff all over that. And, you know, for guys like us who grew up reading that stuff too, it's just such a joy that, you know, we're kind of revisiting, but in a fresh way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you could tell that Matthew was also a big fan of the Punisher when he took on that book. Mm-hmm. He was maybe Garth Ennis has understood the Punisher as well or better than Rosenberg, but that's about it.
Yeah.
You know, he just got it. And you could tell that comes from a place of fandom.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Tom King and Mr. Miracle, you know, him and Garrett's, that story is so incredible. One, because it's so different from what Kirby was doing, but it was based all in that Kirby, you know, craziness from the fourth world. And only a guy who read the Kirby fourth world books over and over again could have come up with something like that. I mean, if you've talked to Tom, you know that his knowledge of Kirby's comics are, you know, it's insane. It's encyclopedic, you know, but, you know, again, sticking with Tom, one thing I like about what he's doing, sidebarring here a little bit, is that he's doing a lot of standalone stories. I don't think we'll see him on a ongoing book like Batman again, unless, you know, he's broke and his comic art habit bankrupts him and he needs a steady paycheck. I think he enjoys the standalone serials that he's doing, usually with, you know, the King of Bourbon, Mitch Garrett.
Yeah.
They're such a great duo together. And I think that works, because if there's one frustration I have with modern day comics is that, man, it is impossible to just pick up a random issue off the books. I know every Marvel press release will say, this is the perfect issue to jump on. It's all BS. It's all BS. I was hearing that stuff when House of X and Dawn of X was happening.
Yeah.
Or no, House of X, Powers of X.
Right.
I get all that stuff confused. And I remember C.B. Cebulski telling me at the Comic-Con just before that came out that it's going to be perfect for anybody who's never read an X-Men book. You're going to be able to step right into it. I go back to the X-Men, back to like the late 70s. I have read almost every issue of the X-Men up to about 2010. Okay, there is no chance that somebody who hasn't read the X-Men knew what the heck was going on in House of X, Powers of X. You know, it was so dense, really fascinating stuff. But I'm an X-Men guy. That's my team. And I was having to reread it two or three times. Not because I was looking for extra things in the story, just to make sure I was following it along. Yeah. It was a lot. It felt like homework.
Yeah, a little bit.
You know, and it got better as it went along. But man, to have the editor-in-chief of Marvel sit there and tell me, oh, it's the perfect jumping on point. Come on. You know, cue the Justin Timberlake emoji. You know, the GIF, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I said, come on. We're making it, we as the industry as a whole, we're making it really hard for fans who see an X-Men movie, which we'll be seeing in a couple of years, it looks like. Fans who see those movies and then come out and they're super excited and they want to see what else they can get about these characters because they're so invested in them now after they see one of those movies. we're not making the right books for them. You know, they're not. They're still great. I had my favorite Marvel series right now is Ben Percy's Wolverine. Fantastic. It's a great series, right? But what about the books tailored so that all my friends' kids who come out of a Marvel or DC movie, and the first person they call is me because I'm the resident nerd, and their dad or their mom puts them on the phone and says, okay, my son's got questions. My daughter's got questions. Do you have time to talk? No, but I'm on the phone, so let's go. And then they ask me, what books should I get? With DC, it's actually easier. This is one thing they do very well, is that their collected editions are much easier to say, hey, you want to learn more about Aquaman and see where that story came from? Go get Geoff Johns's New 52 Aquaman run. Basically, that story is right there. There's other stuff that's not in there, but get that. And one, it's a great book. Great book, you're going to love it. And it's going to fill you in on where this story comes from. You know, and it was great. That was an easy one. Obviously, Batman v Superman, a very simple one to throw a recommendation to. But then you get to the Marvel ones. You know, they're picking from a lot of different stories. You've got Infinity Gauntlet. You've got all the various Thanos stories, right? You've got those. And then you've got, Scarlet Witch and the Vision. You know, and Civil War, you know, where's that coming from? Okay, you got to recommend those. And they don't, it's almost like they need to have a trade paperback program designed just to reprint stories for fans of the movies to come on with a blurb on the front that says, this is what to read if you just saw Endgame. This right. is what to read if you want to get ready for, you know, Falcon and the Winter Soldier. You got to have those books for WandaVision, right? That one's actually a little bit easier because there's three main books. There's Tom's Vision book. There's the Vision Scarlet Witch 12-issue maxi series from the 80s, which is very underappreciated and incredibly bizarre. I don't know if you remember that one.
Yeah.
And House of M, which is, you know, it's going to kill me that I can't remember where I read this, but somebody did a write-up yesterday that talked about how this story is finally giving Wanda her due and making the story about her. Because House of M, while she's the big bad in the story, she's not really a key part of the story in a lot of ways. And it's a great observation that about WandaVision that it's making it about her. I love that we're seeing her in center, you know, on the center stage right there, because she's such a great character. And us old time fans, we know how important Wanda and Scarlet and the Vision are to the Avengers. So it's great to see that. But I don't know if Marvel has taken advantage of the interest in their TV shows and movies because they're not putting those books out there. I've railed against this for years that there should be trade paperbacks or even single issues available at movie theaters for kids to come out. Because I'm telling you, every time I go see one of those movies at a theater, when I come out, all the kids are doing the talking. That was awesome. It's amazing. Take me to the toy store. Take me to this. Yep. You put a $3 double-sized book with a couple of classic stories that relate to it, or a $9.99 trade paperback printed on that paper. That, remember when DC Vertigo used to do the first reprints of 100 Bullets?
Yeah.
And they were like $9.99. And Brian Azzarello says those cheap reprints were the reason that the series became so successful, because it was an easy entry point. $9.99, that's like a bucket of popcorn.
Yep.
Yeah, I'll buy this for my kids to get them to read. Sure. If let's say 40% of the people going in there are comic book fans, right, taking their kids to see it, I bet you most of those will drop $10 to buy a graphic novel that explains more about Endgame and what the story with Thanos is, right? Missed opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, give them a chance to, because, I mean, you and I know where these stories come from. You know, I mean, you mentioned John Byrne earlier and Scarlet Witch not being at the center of House of M. Byrne's Avengers West Coast run, where she first finds out about her kids are not even really human, and she becomes a villain then too. And that's totally her story. That stuff needs to be reprinted too. But unless you're guys like us that have been reading comics for 40 years, you don't even know where to go to look. But if you have
great memory with that one, because it's true. Like, there's a scene in this latest issue that kind of
comes,
it seems like a callback to Byrne's evil Scarlet Witch.
Yeah, and that's a great I love that Avengers West Coast run. It's Burns.
Oh, it's fantastic. Look, She-Hulk's coming out, right? It sounds like from what I've heard, it's going to be based on Dan Slott's run and John Byrne's run. I'm guessing more on Slott's run, maybe in terms of tone. It'll crib from Byrne's run, but Byrne's run was so long ago and kind of poking fun at the comics industry and genre in and of itself. I'm not sure how that would translate as well. Whereas Slott's run is so good because it's set in the courtroom and that makes a lot of sense. So that's great. I just got the She-Hulk omnibus the other day. It's on my spinner rack in the other room. And that's great. Reprint those. But don't just reprint them in the $100 format for crazy nerds like me who are want a really nice hardcover. Reprint the first 12 issues and make it $12.99 or something and do that because people will buy those. I have people emailing me and direct messaging me on Twitter. Maybe they're doing the same to you. Ask me, hey, what are some good sites that can go read analysis of WandaVision? Because I'm super invested in it now. And I go, dude, that's amazing. That's great. And I was like, but I also tell them, I go, why don't you go read the comics?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because they're there. Of course. And to me, I always look at it as this. I love that the Marvel movies don't directly adapt things. Civil War, very different.
Very.
Very different from the comic, right? Doesn't matter. I don't want it to be exactly like the comic. I have the comic book already. They're never going to top that for me because it will cost them $1 billion.
Yeah.
The comic is right there. So what I tell people is go get Infinity Gauntlet. Be prepared. It's going to be very different than what you've seen. You're going to see characters that you won't recognize in there. Doesn't matter. It's still great. So now you have companion material to go along with this movie that you love and you want to see over and over again. One does not have to cancel out the other. They can go hand in hand.
Exactly. Different versions. And, you know, we all have different tastes and sometimes it's tough to go out, you know, to recommend, go to this site, go to that site, because again, you're getting their subjective, what everybody, you know, they themselves is bringing to it. But that brings me to my next question, which is comics and comic fandom is such a great community. You and I both know this, going to conventions and interacting with fans. It's just such a great time. And there's no shortage of podcasts like the Comic Source and plenty of other great podcasts out there and YouTube channels that cover this stuff. You can become a part of that community. You can become a part of the community that Mike has built with his Behind the Panel series, you know, that's what's so great about it. And if you don't know, it is a little bit like homework sometimes, you know, if you love it enough to invest and learn about it, the knowledge is out there, much easier than when we were, growing up reading comics. The internet is such a great resource to go. If you don't want to know about it, Google it. You can go and find it. We didn't have that advantage. So
talk about the Comics Buyer's Guide.
Yeah, exactly. Talk a little bit about the community behind kind of the Sci-Fi Wire and Behind the Panel. You guys have a really good and loyal following, right?
We have. I think we've had a really good following built up over the last couple of years. You know, we for a couple of years, we were working together with some of the Read Pop shows and doing the live stage program. And that really helped expand the name brand. Unfortunately the pandemic really, really impacted us. Like it impacted just about everybody else. Sci-Fi Wire's kind of scaled back a lot of their video programming because without movie junkets, TV junkets, conventions, it's been really tough. I don't know when the next video Behind the Panel I'm going to do. I don't know when that will be. I'm sticking to the weekly column, which is late this week. But I'm hoping that once, you know, the vaccine gets out there and we get at least half the country vaccinated and conventions return, that we're able to go back to doing that again. Cause I miss that. To me, the greatest part about the job has always been going out and talking to the fans and the collectors at shows. For me, look, the conventions are work for me, but it's fun work. Mm-hmm. You know, 30, 40 interviews during one San Diego Comic-Con, the same number at New York Comic-Con. But I'd always make sure to find the time to go walk the floor and talk to people. And it's always nice when somebody recognizes your work and say, hey, you're the guy from Sci-Fi and all that. But it's also nice just to see that they're into the work, you know, people are watching it because it's great to do the work. It's really nice to know that somebody's actually watching it.
Right.
And to me, the comics community lives and dies with conventions. And I think it's really important, and I'm hoping, fingers crossed, that fall of 2021 will be the return of big shows. I think we've seen some small shows already happen. But I think we need the big shows, the big media shows with the panels and all that stuff to happen. When that happens, that's when I know things are starting to return. Because think about the close proximity of everything that happens at a convention. You know, we're lucky as comics fans to be able to always be close to our heroes. No other entertainment industry allows their fans that kind of access to the A-listers of the business, right?
Right, yeah.
You don't see it in movies. You don't see it in television. You certainly don't see it in music. You absolutely don't see it in sports.
Right.
You know, there's a great big barrier there. But comics has always been, hey, doesn't matter if you're Jim Lee, John Byrne, Jack Kirby, Stan Lee, you know, Greg Capullo, Scott Snyder, doesn't matter. The biggest names are always easily accessible to their fans. And it's a wonderful thing, whether it's at their own booths, whether it's signing autographs at a publisher's booth or at a panel, they're always readily available. Plus, you see guys like that walking the floor all the time. I'm sure you've seen comics creators at shows walking the floor because they're fans too. I think it's really important that conventions return and that organizers really figure out the right way to do it, because without that, I think the comics community is going to suffer. We need that. It's not enough just to be on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and on chat boards. I think you need that person-to-person interaction to maintain the fandom. So, I mean, I wrote a story for IGN a couple of weeks ago that talked about how a lot of comics pros like Jimmy Palmiotti, Ben Percy, and even the guy who's the main communications person for San Diego Comic-Con, they expect fall of 2021 to really be when conventions can kind of return. I think if we see San Diego this year, it'll be a virtual show again, maybe a few in-person activities, but there's no chance that the show happens the way we've seen it in the past. No chance.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm thinking hopefully fall. You know, I know C2E2 is rescheduled for December, so maybe that. But yeah, I'm hoping for New York. Because, you know, we've mentioned this a couple times in our chat here is how much these creators, they're fans too. And so, yeah, you do see them walking the floor. But the other thing is they get recharged creatively by being in that environment and by talking to their fans and going to talk to other creators that they're fans of. And so, yeah, the energy at a big show like a New York or a San Diego, it's you can't duplicate it anywhere else.
Nope. I don't think we'll see New York Comic Con. This is pure speculation on my part. I don't see how that show happens. As winter picks up again in New York, I don't see it happening. And I think C2E2 and Emerald City being rescheduled for the end of the year is a good sign of that, because all three of those shows are run by Repop.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But yes, I hope I'm wrong. Prove me wrong. I hope you do. I'm dying to go back to conventions.
Yeah, any favorite con moments? Any you know, one or two things that really stand out in your mind, either fan interaction or with a creator?
Wow. That's tough. Well, I'll give you one from New York Comic Con from a couple of years ago. We had set up our studios in the loft area near Comic Con that overlooks the convention floor. That's where a lot of the sites and TV stations set up for interviews. And so we had set up there. And I'm a big Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. fan, always have been. And somehow or other, we couldn't arrange an interview for them to come to our room. And we were right across from the Marvel.com booth. And obviously, they were going to get everybody connected to a Marvel show there because they're part of the family. So I'm hanging out outside the room, taking a break from one of the 40 interviews I'm doing or something. And then I see Clark Gregg and Jeff Loeb coming by to go to the Marvel.com thing. And I see them, I go, Clark! Now, Clark and I have known each other a long time from interviews. I'm sure if you ask him who I am, he's not going to know my name, but he'll remember me. And he'll definitely know me as the Toomey guy, because one interview I did with him, I had my Toomey backpack that I've had for like a decade. And he saw it and at the end of the interview, he was like, wow, that's a nice backpack. Where'd you get that? I got it downstairs at the Toomey store at 30 Rock, because Sci-Fi's offices are on the 18th floor of 30 Rockefeller. And he goes, really? You think they still have some now? And I go, I'm sure they do. And he went and he told me this the next time I saw him at some press line, hey, I bought that backpack. And he still has it. So I go, Clark, it's Mike, the Toomey guy. And so, hey, how's it going? He goes, yeah, come on, I'm not talking to you. And I go, funny you ask. We couldn't make it work because of the timing. How long are you guys going to be with Marvel.com? And their handler and Jeff Loeb said, no, we don't have any time. And then Clark, God bless him, looks at Jeff. He goes, how much time? How much time? We're going on in like 10 minutes. And they go, how much time do you need with me? I go, how about 6 minutes? Not even 7 minutes, 6 minutes. And then he looks at Loeb and Jeff Loeb looks at him and he goes, at 6 minutes, I'm walking out of the chair and I'm pulling Clark with me because we can't be late for this because it's Marvel stuff. He said, got it. We sat down. We did a great interview. I don't even remember what it was. I think it was part Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., part Jeff talking up Iron Fist or something. I think it was the Iron Fist here. And it was great. Nothing notable came out of the interview. But what I remember about that was that Clark Gregg, good guy that he is, added more work to his plate because by then he'd probably done 40-plus interviews and appearances running around. And he found the time to squeeze in an interview with us. And that meant a lot. That was a good one. I mean, other than that, I mean, I'll give you one from a San Diego show, because you know I love San Diego to death. We did an interview. I'm trying to remember the year. I think it was 2 years ago. Yeah, I think it was 2 years ago. I was talking with John Romita Jr. and I'd set up to do an interview with him about various things. He was on Superman then, but I also wanted to do. I was putting together a piece on the 9/11 Spider-Man issue that him and J. Michael Straczynski did with Scott Hanna, the black cover issue.
Yeah.
And we set it up, and when he goes to sit down and go, hey, look, just wanted to let you know, here's what we're going to talk about. And then at the end, I want to ask you a couple of questions about this book. And he looks at me. I don't know if you know John. He puts on this fake outrage. What? You're kidding me.
Yeah.
You're going to make me cry now? And, you know, he was like playing it off. Oh, it's going to be tough. Okay, fine. You're lucky, Mike. I like you. We'll do it. Fine. No problem. So then we go, and we start. We do the interview, and then we get to that part and we start talking about that. And then it just keeps going on and on because I have a follow-up question and he can't stop talking about it and sharing with it. And he's sharing this little anecdote about how his dad, John Romita Sr., told him he didn't think he should do it because it's too close and he was worried that it would be seen as exploiting a tragedy. But John Jr. really felt strongly about doing it and paying his respects to you know, the people who lost their lives at Ground Zero, the rescue workers who were there all the time. He knew a lot of firefighters and cops, so he felt the responsibility to it. And he goes, I obsessed over every detail, the type of steel that was there. I wanted to draw everything exactly correct so nobody could say that, oh, I cut a corner here and there. And you could see his eyes welling up. And it was funny. And it all began with him telling me, oh, you're going to make me cry. And I thought he was just joking around. And he ended up crying there because that's how powerful it was for him. Still, more than 15 years later, it was great. I'm a big John Romita Jr. fan for a number of reasons, but also because of the fact that he's just a genuine guy. And you could tell even to this day how much he put of himself into that book because it still resonates with him. That was an awesome moment for me.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to why we both do what we do. It's not just I want – people to love comics. I want people to know these creators as people. But I also love the fact that I get to be a conduit between the creators and their fans. And it's the creators getting to, you know, tell their stories and share the fact that, hey man, they're people too. So yeah, it means a lot.
That's important. It's important, man. If people watch my videos and they get something out of it, a little bit of knowledge or a little bit of insight into something that we're talking about in that particular video, then I've done my job.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, it's been great having you on to talk, Mike. You know, I'm a big fan of your work. As we're closing up here, I want to give you a chance. I mean, 2020 was such a challenging year for all of us, but there were some positives. I know for me, I rebuilt my Amazing Spider-Man run that I had sold off stupidly years ago. Was there anything from 2020
nice
that you did? Yeah, from about issue 200 now all the way up to the current, like 850 or whatever. So it's nice. Much longer than my original run that I bought off the rack at, you know, 7-Eleven or what have you. But anyway, anything that you did, that kind of thing, any content you consumed or back issues you bought or series you read that you'd been meaning to, any positive when you look back on 2020, hey, at least I did this,
you know, from a fan
perspective.
I did two massive, deep dives. One was for a book project that I can't really talk about yet, but I read about 500 plus issues of a certain Marvel superheroes. Wow. History to prepare to do this book. And it was great because there were some that I hadn't read. So that was great. One that I can't mention because I just did it for fun was I reread Amazing Spider-Man from about 121 all the way to the present day because I collect comic art and I've been collecting over the last couple of years. I've been focusing more on Spidey art with Mary Jane and great pieces like that. I'm a big, big Mary Jane fan. I think she's one of the great characters in Marvel. And it's amazing to me how much Marvel seems to be trying to bury her when she's just an amazing character. And so I wanted to refresh my memory of the Pete-MJ relationship. So I started with The Death of Gwen, which is really where you can see the beginning of Mary Jane becoming the character that we would all come to love, you know, at the end of 122. And that unbelievable last page. So I read all of that up until the very current, you know, Nick Spencer run now, which I know some people have mixed feelings about it. I'm enjoying it. The one thing I don't enjoy was that they wrote Mary Jane out to give her own series. And then that series went away. Yeah. And now we're back to having no Mary Jane around. And I'm like, what the hell? Come on. So yeah, reading about 700 issues of Spider-Man was one of my pandemic achievements. And somehow I've got to get all this information I have about Pete and MJ and figure out a way to get somebody to pay me to write something about it.
Yeah, that's great. One of my favorite MJ, it's in the 250s and it's the issue where they're in Central Park, just walking around, just having a conversation.
Oh,
kind of
the true story.
Yeah.
The true story of Mary Jane. That's 257.
Yeah, I love that story. That's really where we start to realize how much trauma and what a strong.
I gotta double check. I'm pretty sure that's Amazing Spider-Man 257. But before you know, you put this to, you know, you commit this to the internet and people complain about it. Hold on, let's look that up because
we'll find it. We'll find it for you, everybody.
Because I love that issue. That run, the way they reinserted her back into Pete's life was done so well. It was rushed. That was the right when she was doing the Puma. It was the Puma Ron, was part of it, right?
Ron Friend's art. Yeah.
Oh, Ron Friend's was fantastic. What's it? 259. No, it's 259. See, this is what I'm glad I checked. 259. That's the one. It's got the Hobgoblin on the cover. It's an homage to the Spidey Ditko issue.
Yep.
Yeah, I love that issue. As a matter of fact, I've been looking for pages from that issue forever. And there's a collector who has the opening splash page of them walking through and some of the other ones in there. Because like I said, big fan of hers. And I think, as a matter of fact, I'll go on record as saying that the greatest non-powered character in the history of the Marvel Universe. Prove me wrong.
Off the top of my head, I'd have a hard time. Yeah, I can't.
Ooh, Rick Jones, get out of here.
No way. I was thinking
Jarvis,
more
close. No,
I was thinking, well, Alicia Masters, but she's not as well known. I can't. Willie Lumpkin, maybe.
You could have said somebody could try to make an argument for Myra McTaggart, except now they've made her, the Omega level mutant to end all Omega level mutants.
Yeah, and I think fans of the MCU would probably say Pepper Potts, but they don't realize that in the books, she's nowhere near as important as she is in the
movie. Get out of here with Pepper Potts. Get that nonsense out of here.
Yeah.
Get my court.
You're right, Mike. I really couldn't. There's not.
The only other competition for that comes from Spidey's supporting cast. But as much as I love Aunt May and J. Jonah Jameson, Mary Jane is the greatest non-powered character in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, she's
hands down.
Had the most impact, I would say, both in the comics and in other media. And I mean, when you even talk about stories about the whole One More Day thing, that's one of the biggest comic event where in terms of fan reaction. And that's all Mary Jane. So yeah, I gotta agree with you. That's a great call, Mike. So anyway, like I said, it's been great chatting with you, man. I can't wait when conventions come back just so you and I can hang out. It'd be great to see you in person again.
Yeah, man, I agree.
We'll look forward to that big other thing that you have coming out where you had to read those 500 issues.
I'm hoping to announce it before the end of February.
Okay, so any other work you want to plug, and why don't you let everybody know where they can follow you online, social media and such, so when you do announce those kind of things, they make sure they're up to date.
Yeah, I mean, you can follow me at Twitter and Instagram, at Mike Avila, quite easy. Comments and remarks are always welcome on any stories that I write for Sci-Fi or IGN or anybody else. Just be nice about it, because if you're not, then I'll block you. I can take criticism, but once you start throwing insults, kablock. Yeah. Get lost. But no, I enjoy the interaction, and I like talking with the 99% of the comic fans out there who just like to talk about comics from a positive standpoint. You know, the 1% is the louder part of it, but it's really a very small minority of the comics fan base, and people need to understand that. So, comics fans, come find me. Let me know what you think, and come at me if you think Mary Jane isn't the best.
definitely. And I'll vouch for, you know, I follow Mike and we interact on Twitter. So you can definitely come and eavesdrop on our conversations. And man, there's enough negativity out there in the world and on the internet, especially. So we like to keep it positive. So come and join the conversation. Definitely. So I'll put links to Mike's social media for Twitter and Instagram in the show notes, everybody. So if you're having trouble finding them, you can go click there and find it. Again, thanks, Mike, for chatting. It's been a great kind of behind the panel. And to you listeners, thanks for listening as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
See you, man.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.